Welcome to another episode of the Western Yoga Podcast. I'm honored to be joined today by my dear friend David McGrath, a fellow teacher of Kriya Yoga and student of Roy Eugene Davis. David has recently published a book called The Yogi's Way, Living in Accord with the Yamas and Niyamas. And so this is a book and a workbook that one can work through. It's a program, in other words, to work through the yamas and niyamas, which, for those of you who don't know, is taken out of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. And the yamas is the first limb, niyamas the second limb. And it's essentially an ethical guide for us to follow in our lives as yogis. And we'll let David explain that a bit more. And so, David, thanks so much for agreeing to do this interview, and I'm thrilled to have you on this episode.
It's a pleasure to be here, Chris. It's good to chat with you again.
Absolutely. And David is from Ireland, lives in Ireland. And we met some years ago at Center for Spiritual Awareness in Georgia. At some retreats that we were doing together, and he had done some extended stays at CSA, and really to dive deep into everything that Mr. Davis was teaching to truly live it. And so I have a lot of respect for David, and he's an excellent author. I highly recommend purchasing a copy of his book, which is available on Amazon. Is there a Kindle version as well?
There is. There's a Kindle version.
Perfect. Yeah. Cool. And so do you want to just introduce the yamas and niyamas? Some of my listeners might not be 100% familiar with the philosophy.
Yeah. Well, it depends on how familiar you are with yoga, how you might perceive the yamas and niyamas. I'm after writing a book, so how I perceive the yamas and niyamas can cause me to talk an awful lot, but I'll try and keep it simple in some ways. Like you said, it's two aspects of the eight limbs of yoga. It's two of the limbs, the first two limbs, and that in itself can be a whole conversation, how the yamas and niyamas as two limbs within the eight limb system play a role, and how significant they are in helping the practitioner with their practice. But just to hone in on what the yamas and niyamas in themselves are, so yamas means codes of conduct or codes of restraint, and then the niyamas means codes of observance, or things that we're to adhere to. So you've got things that we're to try and avoid to do. They're the yamas. And then five things which we're endeavoring to nurture, cultivate, adhere to. And they're the niyamas. As you mentioned them as ethics. And this is, I find this is interesting, because some people will use different terminology in trying to translate into English what the yamas and niyamas are. And ethics stands as a good substitute. Some people use morals, and other people codes of conduct, and lots of different ways. But I try to refrain from seeing them as something of a social construct which is being imposed upon us, you know, like a commandment of how we're supposed to behave. And more as a framework of principles. So you got 10 principles, the five yamas and five niyamas, and they act as principles that we can develop a relationship to, and in that way experience life in harmony with how it wants to express. But as opposed to trying to live by some rules which have been imposed by some external force, they're more an innate part of who we are aspiring to be. And through our developing our relationship towards them as principles, as pillars of forming a part of how we can integrate ourselves and be part of life, we can then embody them and not see them so much as a rule book, but more as a natural way of being, which is in accord with what life itself is doing.
Yeah, that's a nice way of approaching it. I have a bit of a complicated relationship with the yamas and the yamas, only because it has to do with my childhood, my upbringing, coming up in a Southern Baptist church, very strict, and watching people, observing people who were quite ethical by at least Christian standards or Western Christian Protestant standards, very ethical, moral people, wholesome folks, but without being judgmental, just spiritually very ignorant, you know, holding on to very silly, kind of goofy, antiquated beliefs and all that. But then on the other side, I've also come across people who are quite awake spiritually, who aren't nearly as ethical, I suppose, as they could be or should be, perhaps. And so I have observed that, and let me put this into context. Typically, when we talk about the yamas and niyamas and yoga, usually we say that there is a sort of reciprocal relationship between the yamas and niyamas and then the rest of our practice. In other words, if we are practicing these ethics and morals, well, then it should have an effect on our meditation practice. Likewise, our meditation practice and our awakening process should organically and naturally begin to improve our morals and ethics. In other words, they have this sort of direct proportional relationship with one another. But I have observed that that's not always the case. And in other words, I have observed many ethical, moral people who are not spiritually awake at all. And likewise, I've observed a lot of spiritually awake people who aren't as moral or ethical as they could be or should be. And so while I agree philosophically in theory that this relationship should exist and can exist in the real world, I have observed that it's not always the case. And I wonder if you've observed the same thing and if you have any theories about why that might be the case.
I think that observation, I'm not sure if it comes to everybody who is committed to their practice of yoga or whatever the Enlightenment tradition might be. But I feel that I had my own version of that experience, and not even in terms of looking out and observing the lives of other people, but even just in terms of my own life and my own personal practice. I think that your comment that there's people out there who live in a very ethical way whilst never really demonstrating or being interested in or wanting to cultivate some kind of deeper insight and awaken them to more of an understanding of their essential nature. While then, in contrast, there's people who don't seem to give as much or pay much as much attention to the details of how they're engaging in life in terms of how they're living ethically, but pay a lot of attention to the formal spiritual practices. And then as a consequence, show or portray themselves to be very spiritually awake. But if the truth be known, there's a lot to them that proves that a little bit conflictual, to be a bit conflicting. And I think I was one of those individuals where I was very focused on the formal practices, and we know the formal practices to be those things where we dedicate a time in our day to sit down and do them, such as it might be asana or the pranayama breathing techniques, or the using different concentration techniques to cultivate a state of meditation with the aspiration to experience different states of samadhi absorption. So I was definitely one of those people who was very committed to those formal practices and made time in the morning and made time in the evening and often made time in the middle of the day. And it's not to say that I was a bad person, but because of the amount of focus that I had on those specific internal formal practices, I wasn't equipped, maybe is the word, to be able to navigate my relationship to the other practices, the yamas and niyamas, which were more about, I suppose, my informal practice, about my actual engaging with life on a day-to-day level and engaging with people and the world around me. And when I say I wasn't equipped, what I really mean is that the yamas and niyamas, like if we just maybe back up a little bit, in our formal practice, we're in a kind of incubated, protected space where we're left alone with certain practices which have been shared with us. We take them on and we apply them in whatever way we can. And then we'll talk about how we use them. Maybe we'll refer to our teachers and tell them how we're using them. Maybe there'll be some feedback. But it's all about something that we're doing in a very protected space. The yamas and niyamas, they're about how we are living in every single moment. And the feedback is direct and instant because it's coming through the people that we love, our family, our friends, the people we work with, the society as a whole is feeding back to us how we are engaging life. So in our meditation practice, in the formal practices, we are being fed back to from the internal process, which ultimately is a process which is trying to facilitate our disengaging and disidentifying and disconnecting from everything that's going on so that we can have an experience of beingness without identification. But the yamas and niyamas, it's the opposite. We are totally engaged. We're totally connected. We're totally identifying with everything that's going on. And so we're not in our comfortable, secure, private, isolated space. Now we're very much exposed to the reality of manifested creation. And so the feedback is, as I mentioned, is direct and it's constant. And so it's very easy to have a very grounded, formal practice, one where you feel confident and you feel good about and you feel like you might be making progress. And this is from my own case, I'm speaking from my own experience. And then not really be as aware or as insightful about the informal practice. You have a sense of it, and maybe some of your listeners will have a sense of it, where you get up from your meditation practice and you feel like you're in this special space and now you're ready for anything and you're going to enter into the world with this, let's say, clarity that you've experienced in your meditation practice and through the formal practices. And then you go to engage in the world and maybe it just takes 5 minutes, maybe 3 minutes, maybe longer, maybe 10 minutes or 15 minutes, but not long. And then you realize that that's all being kind of washed over by the reality of facing the details of life. And I think this is where, if we look at the objective of yoga, which is to liberate ourselves to being able to experience oneness at all times, regardless of whether we're in meditation, formal meditation practice, or we're engaging in life, I see the formal practices as a means to help us with the informal practice, which is the yamas and niyamas. But in turn, that by paying attention to the yamas and niyamas as a set of principles, as a framework, we can help ourselves go deeper and use the formal meditation practices with greater success or with greater advance. When you talk about the people who have these qualities and yet have no interest in formal spiritual practices, I think that if you are demonstrating a way of being in the world where it basically encourages respect from the world itself, a way of being in the world which is supportive of the expression of life, then you experience that respect or appreciation from everything else that's going on around you. There's a natural payback from living in this ethical manner that life kind of works with you. And that's not to say that things always go smoothly. People, you know, can rob from you and they can cheat you and they can say bad things to you. But who you are in relation to those things is well grounded. And so you can navigate those situations in a way which ultimately allows you to experience greater clarity and a sense of being able to engage in life in a trusting, comfortable manner. And so there may not be as much of an impetus to go on and try and figure out some way of sorting out all the mishmash of what's going on at a deeper level. And, you know, this can be referred to as karma yoga in many ways. And so, yes, I just to relate it back to you, what you said, yes, I have noted within myself, and as a consequence, I can see it in others, that there can be a tendency to think that formal spiritual practices are the whole thing, and then the informal practices being the kind of person that engages in life in an ethical way. There can be a kind of a discord there. And those people who we meet, and especially as a practitioner, someone who engages in formal spiritual practices, it can be very easy to find fault in people who don't engage in formal spiritual practices. While at the same time, the person that we're criticizing is a very grounded, very ethical person in terms of how they engage in life. And so you were talking about the idea that people who are involved in formal spiritual practices sometimes have notions which are very, I'm not sure what words you used exactly, but the idea is that can be just a little bit off point, or maybe demonstrate a certain degree of naivety, or maybe we want to say is spiritual immaturity, or whatever terms we might use. And I suppose all of it really just comes down to how we see ourselves in relation to manifested reality, how we see ourselves in relation to what's behind manifested reality. And some people may come at it through their own, subjective experience, and see that the most important thing is to live life in an ethical, structured manner in relation to what's going on around them. Other people might do it to a certain degree or not. And then others may get involved in formal spiritual practices, hoping that that's going to fix everything else. It's very hard to break it down and categorize all the different types of people and the different styles and approaches and ultimately psyches in the world. But your comment, I think, does have weight. And I suppose just to finish up on what I'm saying, two things would be, as someone who's involved in formal spiritual practices, there is definitely a space for us to be able to appreciate that those who are not involved in formal spiritual practices can be a very, very fine individual who demonstrates and expresses their spiritual essence in a magnificent way. And then the other point would be that as formal spiritual practitioners, that paying attention to the principles of the yamas and niyamas just gives us a framework, not to feel that we are supposed to do this or not supposed to do that, but to be able to cultivate a sense of how we want to be in relation to the expression of life, and how we would like to be a conduit or an expression of life itself, and not get in the way, but more facilitate that expression.
Right. Yeah, I think both things are important, right? Yeah. You know, if we look at even the teachings of Jesus, for example, mm-hmm. you know, he did have his sort of like mystical, esoteric kind of enlightenment teachings, but then he also discussed the importance of ethical living, wholesome living, how we interact with others, morality, and all of that. And so I think he sort of emphasized both. Now, in the yoga tradition, as you know, the emphasis is far more on the formal practices and the super conscious states, the samadhi states, the realizations, the awakening to our true nature. And oftentimes we sort of forget or de-emphasize the morality and the ethical living. And why do you think that is? Why is yoga, especially if you look at something like the tantric tradition or the hatha yoga tradition, there's far more emphasis on the physical practices and also the pranayama practices, the mantra practices, the meditation, and very little time and energy is really given to morality and ethical living and all of that. What's going on there? Why do you think that is the case? And we're specifically talking about the yoga, tradition.
Well, maybe I won't be able to give the exact answer, but I can give a perspective on it. Like yoga nowadays within our culture, and specifically in Western culture, is, as we were mentioning before we started the podcast, we were talking a little bit about this. It's being transmitted by people who've received the teachings and who are sharing the teachings with the best of intention, but who may not be necessarily skilled or be in a position to involve themselves in the goings on of their students' lives. And I think this comes back to a little bit when they talk about the three types of gurus. I know that Sri Aurobindo talks about there's just going to be an influence upon the consciousness of the teacher if he opens him or she opens himself up to the consciousness of the student. So if we put it in layman's terms, if a student approaches the teacher and the teacher opens themselves up to hear the details of the student's lives, then all of the details of that student's lives now is transmitted to the consciousness of the teacher, and they have all of this extra load of impressions upon their own consciousness. And if they go for all their students, they're going to have many, many extra impressions upon their consciousness. And if we just look at modern world in terms of modern yoga teachers, there may not be the capacity to contain all of that. And so when you talk about the emphasis on the yamas and niyamas, when you're giving a discourse or a workshop or a retreat, things which are tangible, things which can be picked up and put down and applied, and those things can be talked about easily. How do we talk about trust? How do we talk about non-violence? We can talk about it, but there's going to be always a degree of superficiality, because even when we talk about God, what you think God to be, what I think God to be, what anybody else listening to this thinks God to be, we'll all have our own opinion on it. And a conversation about it might be difficult to mediate. And it's the same if we start talking about what's truth. What is truth? What does it mean to live in a manner which is truthful? What does that actually mean? And like that can take a good deal of discussion. And it would also naturally, I think, as a consequence of opening up the discussion, invite participants to start sharing personal life experiences and bringing things to the table, which might be outside the remit of what the yoga teacher actually wants to be dealing with. And so teaching breath work or teaching physical postures, they're more black and white. Teaching concentration techniques, they're more black and white. While at the same time, students do come with, well, I had this experience in my meditation practice, and what can I do? What can I do there? But all of everything they're talking about is within their internal experience. So we can guide, but there's no real onus on us to figure it out, because they're still left alone with that specific thing. But if we start listening to people about what's going on in their life, and we don't have the, let's say, the skill set or the ability to contain it, it can cause, it would put a responsibility on the teacher, which is maybe beyond what they actually want. And also it would require an ability on the part of the teacher to be able to navigate it in the way where it's empowering for the student and not disempowering. Because we've all heard of yoga teachers who sometimes get themselves in trouble in terms of how they're relating to their students. And I reflect back on when you talked about the traditions, specifically of tantric yoga. Even when we look at the Kriya yoga tradition, there was a tradition of students having a relationship with the teacher, whereby the teacher knew to some degree what the life of the student was like. And so it was more of a community-based practice. And not to say that the teacher or the master was exalted in all cases as being some revered character that the students need to bow down to, but sometimes it would even be a brother disciple or somebody who had been practicing for a longer period of time. They had shoulders that they could shoulders to lie on, but maybe it's the wrong expression, but they had people that they could connect with, or where they felt part of a community. And so adhering or upholding a way of living which was in accord with the yamas and niyamas would be communicated to the other people in that community. It would be very well known. It would be there for everybody to see. In our society, people might practice yoga and go to a class and maybe take part in retreats and see a group of people, leave that group and not see the same people again for maybe a year or 6 months. Or maybe they've got the same class that they go to every week. But again, the people might be coming and going. They might not always have that grounded community, which is helpful and supportive in terms of nurturing an understanding of how it helps us to engage in society in a manner which is ethical. Because we're not having feedback from our contemporaries, our peers within the tradition. Instead, we're left on our own having the feedback on ourselves. So I think when we look at Yogananda, he had a very intimate relationship with Sri Yukteswar. Sri Yukteswar had an intimate relationship with Lahiri Mahasaya. When I look at Roy, he had a relationship with Yogananda, which allowed him to express whatever was going on for him at different times during his practice at those initial stages and initial years. But I think I had a thought there and it slipped. But it's coming. I get a sense that it's coming from the tip of my tongue and it's forming the words of my tongue. Let me see if I can remember this thought. I'm not sure if it's going to come out exactly the way it was before, but basically the position of a teacher in the West now is not the same as the position of a teacher in the yogic tradition as it was traditionally. And so the yamas and niyamas, require a great deal of attention. And as we mentioned, attention in regard to how we live every experience, our day-to-day experience, they require that. But within the West, they don't get that kind of attention just because everything is different. There's the sense of community, while it might be there, it might be not be as so closely knit. While they have a teacher, the teacher might not be in a position to offer a presence to be able to contain and not help the student to work through whatever is going on. So the variables are very different. So I don't think it's an environment in the West which is comfortable for people to be able to talk about the yamas and niyamas. And with that said, then, like we were talking before we began the podcast, that the therapy and what we have in the West, the different structures we have in the West to help people to navigate their own psyche, is a tool which can contain what's going on for people. And just to round it all up, I see that fundamental, or maybe the fundamental objective of our practice is to understand the ego and our relationship to the ego and its presence as being that which causes us not to know the truth of what we are. And then if we look at the ego's job is to stand strong, hold its position, and put up as big a fight as it can to avoid anything from destroying it. So our goal is directly in opposition to the main goal of the ego. And all that's going to come for us in our practice is resistance and resistance and resistance and resistance from the point of view of the ego. And depending on our aspiration, our commitment, and our ability to navigate those resistances, we may find our spiritual practices more or less difficult. And so having a resource or something that we can refer back to when the resistances really, really play up, I think I can't define exactly what's the best way that is for everybody in their context of their own practice, but definitely it would seem that that mechanism, something to be able to navigate resistances when they become overwhelmingly discouraging as we're moving through our practice, is something which I think maybe has been lacking in Western practice.
And it's also important, I think, to understand the historical context out of which, you know, Patanjali comes. We're talking about somebody that lived 2,000 years ago, right, in ancient India. He was seemingly a renunciate, monastic, and lived, of course, you know, in a caste system, in a very chauvinistic society as well. So how trustworthy are these ethics that he laid out? In other words, do you believe that the yamas and niyamas are universal? Or are they a product of his cultural context and historical context? In other words, can we apply, that ethical guide that he provided us, is that applicable in our modern Western society?
Good question. I think when you're asked a question like that, thoughts just go firing around and you're trying to go, where will I start here? But I'll start from the start, I suppose. If we just look at the concept or the principle of truth, now, even between you and I, we might have a conversation about truth, which could go on for a good few hours, bring another person in and the conversation go on longer. And we're all, you know, you and I are from not the same culture, but cultures which share a lot in common. But even that said, even though you're from the United States and I'm from Ireland and we both speak English, what an American or somebody from the United States might, the manner in which they might go about expressing what it means to be truthful, not as an individual, but as a somebody who's grown up in that culture, might be different to how an Irish person would go about it. We might have little gray areas where you don't have gray areas. You might be more gray about things which we're very black and white about. And that's on a cultural level. But then the individuals within that culture. And then you've got cultures which are extremely different to our cultures, where the idea of what it means to be truthful might be more related to the ego person, or it might be more related to the favor of the community or the society as a whole. So that's just looking at truth we can look at it as a principle, but it's a concept. And so this concept, when you say, is it universal? The challenge, I think, is in that we reduce the concepts to the word. And so we think of truth, non-stealing, you know, non-attachment. That's fine. The words are there. But I think what's the way these principles are most effective is when we understand how we as individuals, as, you know, with our own subjective point of view, engaging within manifested reality, that we really examine the concept of the word and what it means to us. And so in this way, it's a bit like God, you know. The word God is very grand, and the concept that it connotates is just immense. You know, you could have a whole dictionary on definitions of what God is. But even with the whole dictionary on definitions of what God is, it's not enough for every single individual in the world. And the same is true of these principles, that although we can engage in conversations about what truthfulness and what non-harm is, we can do this. And it's helpful for us to be able to navigate our own relationship to it. But I don't think it stops there. I think that it is something that we must be relentless with. We have to be relentless with it. Because the way I see it is that yoga is the ultimate concept. And I know it's translated in many different ways. I use the term oneness. So if we say oneness, and that's just a word, and it's a word which suits my perspective, and it may not suit your listener's perspective, but it's a word which I've come to see, maybe that's the most appropriate way for me to be able to talk about this state of yoga, this yoga union, oneness. And so I've got my perspective on it. And that in itself is a concept which is beyond our capacity to conceptualize. So we can have hours, and we do. We have workshops and retreats, and we have books and more books and more books. And then with Patanjali in his efforts to try and guide the individual to live and engage in life with and from that perspective of oneness, is saying, okay, well, oneness, you might break it down to mean basically there's no harm. There's trust in life, there's not stealing, there's truthfulness, you don't have attachment to things, you know, you're content. So he puts in this framework. And from what I've seen of other ancient texts, Sanskrit texts, there are usually qualities or characteristics or some mention of the attributes which can be associated with somebody who's trying to practice yoga. But the way I like to see it is that the fundamental thing we're trying to experience is yoga. And that thing is beyond our capacity to conceptualize. So the best we can do is to break it down. What is yoga? Well, yoga means being truthful. But what does it mean to be truthful? So even those 10 principles, we go from trying to break yoga down, we break it down to 10 principles. Then break those 10 principles down. What does each one of those mean? And again, it can be books and books and books and books, which surprisingly there aren't. But that's just because it's very personal. And in order to write a book about the yamas and niyamas, I think it, and the approach I've taken with the book is to make it as personal an experience for the reader as it can be, because otherwise it's just giving a version of what it means. And it can't be that. It needs to be something which is embodied. It needs to become the term truth or nonviolence or whatever it might be, needs to be not just a word, but a whole experience of living, a whole approach to engaging in life.
And how rigid should we be? I had the experience, for example, my first few years spent with Mr. Davis, studying with him and all that, I put a lot of pressure on myself to adhere to what I thought was the ideal yogic lifestyle and the yamas and niyamas. And what I found was that my inability to live up to those standards caused quite a bit of stress, guilt, shame, which are the same emotions I felt growing up in the Southern Baptist Church, which I, you know, didn't really enjoy. And which is why I became interested in yoga and Buddhism and Eastern traditions and whatnot in the first place. And so I found that my inability to live up to these ethical standards was actually creating more vrittis and more samskaras and more karma. And that when I was able to relax and loosen up a little bit and not be so rigid, I was happier and more peaceful.
Yeah.
And so And I'm sure you've had a similar experience. A lot of us do. And so what wisdom can you share with us about what I just described? You know, in other words, how can we not be so hard on ourselves?
Well, just to, I don't know if I can qualify it as wisdom, would I say first? Then we can just reflect on whether, but
well, I consider you to be quite wise, so whatever you can share with me would be wonderful, and with my listeners, because that was tough for me to navigate, you know. And I went through a lot of like sort of internal conflict, like, gosh, you know, I'm just a piece of shit, you know, like, gosh, I can't live up to these ethical standards. What's wrong with me? You know, like I'm a sinner, you know?
Yeah.
And I kind of went back into that same mentality and sort of began self-sabotaging and all this. Now, of course, this is my own personal junk that we're discussing here, but I think that other people have had a sort of similar experience with trying to live up to, you know, some type of moral ideal or something like that. And so where do we draw the line? In other words, is there a middle path that we can find where we're trying our best to live up to something, but, you know, if that day we don't accomplish it, how should we react, or how should we treat that failure? And I'm putting failure in quotations here.
Yeah, the whole thing, you know, it's very interesting, because there's a lot of different variables in the world which we can use to talk about what is the cause, you know. So like yoga is just one thing, and then other people are part of other spiritual traditions, but then other people are involved in science, and other people are in maths, and other people are financial brokers, and the world is full of interesting things. But the issue, which is maybe at the backbone of what you're talking about, the anxiety or the sense of overwhelming self-criticism that causes, I think that can happen to anybody in any, let's say, sphere of life experience. But if we bring it back to people who are practicing, like there's before we got engaged with our yoga practices, there was already a capacity within us to want to be a certain version of ourselves, to use modern terminology. You know, we had an idea in our heads of who we were in the world, and we had an idea of how we expressed within this realm of existence. And so we had this idea, but I'm not, when I say we had the idea, I don't mean that we had it all written down and defined, but somewhere in the murkiness of all our thinking, in all that grayness in our mind, we had a sense of, this is who I am, and this is the kind of person I am, and this is how I do things. But if we had been actually asked to write down what that actually means, we would have had a huge amount of difficulty, because it's all transient and moving, and not, we can't tie it down. And that's the whole thing about it. We have this perception that we're something that we can't actually tie down. But then we hold it to be something of great esteem. You know, we hold it on a pedestal, and we go about and we engage in life in ways where we can try and massage and build it up and make it better and make it get more confidence behind it, you know, get a sense of, well, now I know this is who I am, this is what I'm about. And we're building up this great fortress to protect this sense of, this is who I am. But as I just said, like, the whole thing is very transient and fleeting. So anything that we build up is built on shaky foundations. It's not going to work. But it's the same thing that we've always done, is to have a sense of, this is who I am. And then we're now, as we continue in our life and move through the different experiences, we go, you read a book and you're going to go, that book was amazing. And now I'm going to take on all that book told me to do. And I'm going to be even better. And then we watch a video, or we go to a thing and we say, this person said all these great things. I wish I could remember everything they said, but the things I'm going to remember, whatever it is, now I'm going to be a better person. Now it's going to be, this is going to be me, and I'm going to be really strong. And so we keep on building up the fortress. And with yoga practice, the same thing happens where we're given everything and we're going to, yeah, I'm going to nail this. I'm going to get it down. And then I'm going to be this rock solid, unshakable, unwavering, totally cool, charismatic, perfect individual. And that's what we're kind of driving at. And so there's a very, we're setting ourselves up to be something which is ideal, which is like the kind of a utopic version of what we perceive that's ourselves to be. And that's a very high standard. And so we are, as much as we have that as our center of who we think we are, we also have the part of us which says, you're a failure. You got it wrong. You didn't do it. And, you know, the part which is trying to help us to get towards being that ideal, but the way it does it is with lashing its whip and, you know, pushing us towards us. So it creates guilt, a lot of guilt. And the guilt, in turn, you've got anxiety and guilt and anxiety and guilt, and the whole thing becomes a mess. And where do we draw the line? Well, it's interesting because one of the niyamas is non-attachment. And then you've also, you've got saucha, santosha is acceptance and contentment. Santosha is, so you've got two niyamas which are kind of pointing us in the direction of just let it go and also just be happy and trust. But, you know, it's kind of like when somebody tells you don't be sad, you're kind of like, okay. And but you're thinking about sadness, that whole thing about the elephant, you know, it's kind of like
just relax.
Exactly.
That always works.
What always works are creating an effect. You know, maybe not relaxation, but another effect. And that's it. It's kind of there's a duality going on. So when I talk about looking at the words, like if we look at that word of santosha, contentment, acceptance, and we really understand our relationship to it, if we really, really examine how we engage with that concept, we would actually start to see that actually my beating myself up is not acceptance. So built into that concept, it's built in, it's right there. And the other one of non-attachment, it's not that, it's not attachment and it's not detachment, it's non-attachment. So it's not that things can't happen in our experience of our physical existence, emotional existence, or mental existence. It's not that these things can't take place. It's just that we accept them. And that's all we have to do is accept them. So we have this notion of being perfect. It's the whole thing we're working towards. But yoga isn't about becoming perfect. And I know that in certain traditions, they talk about the perfected being. But that idea of the perfected being is not an I or a you. It's a being. And it's so it's not about our ego becoming perfect, because that's just a flawed mission right from the very start. But a lot of us, when we engage in the practice, are coming at it from that point of view. And as we said, like as I mentioned earlier, it's natural that we would, because the ego's main job is to resist. So if the ego sees all this stuff that's trying to usurp it and get it out of its throne, as Yogananda would say, take it from its position, it's going to manipulate the situation for its own betterment. So when we come into yoga, we approach it already with the tendencies which are going to cause us to find it challenging. We're already set up to find difficulty straight away. And when we look at the limbs of yoga, I think when we look at it as a systematic approach in terms of our relationship to the physical, our body, relationship to the you can call it energy or the emotional body, the prana, and then relationship to our mind. Like everything is about systematically developing and nurturing and becoming more attuned to our relationship to our physical, emotional, and mental body. Ultimately, to be able to just get really good at just experiencing it and not taking it all as being something that we're in charge of and control of, and that we need to kind of manage this way and that way so that we are perfect people. And now look at me now, I'm such a great person. It's not about that. It's about being able to know your position as the seer expressing through these, the witness expressing through these aspects of reality, and then trusting that you have a way which is part of your way of expressing in the world, your dharma, your duty, and just trusting it. And so you can be sincere and true to you. And so if sometimes that means that the anger in your body, you need to vent the anger in your body, then maybe that's what's most appropriate in terms of your dharma, your truth. Mm-hmm. And so nothing is black and white, but I think that's what we want when we come in. We want it all black and white so that we can have simple bricks to build up the fortress, to make us perfect, figured out, sorted. Now I can move on.
Yeah, you brought up something about people trying to demonstrate or trying to show their high moral character and all that. And that has manifested itself, especially on social media. This has come to be known as virtue signaling. And you see
the term?
Virtue signaling. So you're signaling to the world how virtuous you are.
Okay.
And you see this happening sometimes very obvious, sometimes it's very clever and subtle, but it's the ego's way of trying to show society just how virtuous and moral they are. And and of course we're talking mostly about, you know, political things and social issues and things of that nature, but it can also come into play when we talk about spirituality or religion and all of that. So that's another ego trap, isn't it? That once maybe we do reach a certain degree of you know, morality or you know, what have you, then the ego's initial sort of impulse is to show that off to others. You know, it's crazy, and so that's just one more way the ego becomes involved in this entire process. And so that obviously is to be avoided as well.
Just to say on that point, I think, you know, we express on a human level, and I think in terms of our humanity, we all experience a sense of alienation, isolation, and aloneness, despite the amount of friends we might have in our life, and despite the amount of positive relationships, you know, what we might call positive relationships, supportive relationships that we might have in our life. There's an aspect of us which is disconnected. And this is all part of non-duality. Like, because we are in relationship to one another, we are intrinsically disconnected and separate from one another. And so that separation, we feel that at a deep level, that sense of alienation, that sense of lack, of not having, not being whole, that whole thing, that we carry that around with us. And the best thing we have to fill that lack is our sense of significance, I suppose, the sense of feigning. We feign or we fake some sense of being a singular entity, you know, being an I that has it all figured out to the best that we can, so that we don't, just to compensate for our sense of feeling alienated and separate from everything.
Sort of a defense mechanism, armor.
Yeah. It's a defense mechanism, and it's part of our, I suppose, our evolution and our development is kind of that in order for us to be able to engage in manifested reality, there needs to be relationships. There needs to be a subjective position, subject to object kind of relationship going on all the time. The challenge for us, I think, is that we've evolved to have this self-awareness. And so, although I'm in a relationship to you, there's a part of me which you never know. And there's a part of me which you'll never know. And despite all the words we use and all the experiences we share and all everything else, I'm deeper than that. And you're deeper than that. And there's a depth to our existence which is beyond our capacity to conceptualize and to put into words. And so there's a real honest aspiration to reconnect with that in some way or another. And we try to fill it in lots of different ways. But the ego will try to do that job. And the way the ego will do it is by picking up this thing, picking up that thing, getting that thing, getting into this relationship. You know, it has all its different ways of doing it because it's relying on the external. But we have the capacity through yoga practice to move it the other way and to see that all those external relationships, they support the ego, but there's something behind it all that, not that it's going to give us a sense of wholeness. What I mean by that is not to make the ego whole, because it's not going to make the ego whole, but it's going to help us to see what the ego actually is, and what that it's actually an aspect of our expression which allows us to be in the world, but it's not what we actually are. And so we shift our perspective on what's going on, and the ego becomes more something which is a construct which allows everything to occur, but it's not what we actually are. And we're, what we actually are is beyond definition and is not actually in need of any relationship or one to the other connection. It is self-sustaining and unlimited, undefining. And that space is what we come familiar with as we continue with our formal, with our spiritual practice, formal and informal.
Yeah, what you're describing is something that I tell some of the folks I work with sometimes, you know, and they ask me, you know, how have you changed? How has your ego changed, your personality changed, and all that in the last, you know, however long you've been meditating or on the path or what have you? Not much. You know, it's I'm just as crazy as I ever was. I'm just more aware of it now, you know, and that's the difference. It's like, you still have all these traits and these characteristics and these tendencies and subconscious patterns and habits and all these things. But whereas they used to be, formerly I was not consciously aware of all of these things. They were just happening. It was like this automatic sort of sleepwalking autopilot kind of state. And I'm still in that state a lot of the time. But now, through the practices and everything, it's just that I've become more aware of all of those things. And so now there's like a little bit of space. There's like this gap now that didn't exist before. In other words, you know, there's this observer that, you know, I have more familiarity with now through the practices and whatnot. And I'm able to observe when these habits and patterns and tendencies come up, whereas before, it was just automatic. It's just who I was, you know, quote unquote. This is my personality. This is just who I am. You know, it is what it is. But now I'm able to sort of, at the very least, just be more aware of the ego and its tendencies and habits and patterns and everything. But I wouldn't say that my ego has changed or that I've purified the ego all that much. I wouldn't say that at all, but maybe that's possible. Maybe you can purify the ego and all of that. But I'm not there, but at the very least I've created this sort of space or gap in between what I am actually in reality. And then this ego that, expressing out in the world and within my social interactions and all of that. And I think the yamas and niyamas can also help with that process, no?
Yeah, like when you talk about the ego and the purifying of the ego, and then earlier I mentioned about the ego just putting up an absolute resistance. I suppose the resistance relates to the process of purification, because the resistances are the stronghold or the weapons of the ego. And when we talk about purifying the ego or purifying our awareness or purifying our conscious awareness, what's actually going on there? And then we can relate it back to the second sutra, which is, you know, yoga is the neutralization of everything that's going on in the mental field or in the chitta. Like when we go back to that, the yoga is the neutralizing of everything. So then when we think about the purification process and the resistances, which are the weapons of the ego, how does that all play in together? And we have an an aspiration to experience yoga. We don't know what that actually means. We just read about it and we hear teachers talking about it, but we don't really know because we are moving towards having the direct experience of it. We get glimpses into it, maybe periodically, but what does it actually mean to liberate your conscious awareness? What does that actually mean? We can only really imagine. So we're trying to move towards this thing. We're told that the way to do it is by neutralizing everything that's going on in our mind. But then our teachers tell us, you're not trying to stop the thoughts. You go, okay, so I'm not trying to stop the thoughts, but I'm trying to neutralize them. What does that actually mean? So the many layers of complexity start kind of peeping their head into the instruction of what yoga actually is. And all of it, all the layers are being met with the ego. They're not being met with any... We're not there yet. We're not there yet. We're still working towards getting to that point of realization, but we're not there. So when we receive the teachings, we receive them, and we have, if we look at the four aspects of mind, we have the ahamkara, the ego maker, the I maker, which is looking at them and is very strong and usually has a lot to say about everything. And then we have that part of us, the buddhi, the intelligence. But the two of them are like, you know, siblings. But the ego has taken the position of the older brother, and the buddhi is just like the small child who's in opposition to it and trying to get a bit more status. But the ego is taking the concept and twisting it and turning it and manipulating and doing everything to it to try and figure it out and get it all sorted and get it in a way where, oh no, I got it now. I understand exactly what the teacher is talking about. Or if I do it like this every day, for this amount of time, it's all going to work. 2 + 2 = 4, no problem, all done. And so the ego gets the information, but then just does whatever it wants with it for the sake of its own perseverance. And the buddhi, all the while, the intelligence, that part of us which is knowing, is trying to pick out the truth from it and trying to work with it as best it can. And so the whole process afforded to us in yoga is one of purification. But that purification, what are we purifying? Our conscious awareness. And how are we purifying our conscious awareness? We're purifying it by basically neutralizing the things that prevent us from staying in that conscious awareness. But we could change that. We're achieving a state of oneness, a state of attunement to beingness, a state of yoga oneness through neutralizing the resistances of the ego. Not that the ego is going to disappear. We still have our individual perspective. We still have the characteristics which may express from time to time through, the body that we have. But they're seen, the resistances have been seen, and they've been worked through in just as a default of our having adhered to the practice of yoga. And then the yamas and niyamas, they function in terms of, I know that in our formal meditation practice, we are often instructed or encouraged to contemplate our essential nature. What am I? Who am I? What is it that is about me? And we can contemplate that in our formal practice, and we can carry it through to our day-to-day living. When we're engaged in our day-to-day living and we have the different yamas and niyamas, we can, the way I've laid it out in the book is that, you don't have to listen, you don't have to remember all 10 of them and try to do all 10 of them all the time through every day. If you just take one and you say, okay, how am I living with non-attachment today? How is that going for me? And if you do that sincerely, and there's a reflection on it, and there's an engagement with it as being something which is of great significance, tantamount or equal to our actual formal practice, like we really take it on, it's going to be a path which is going to lead us closer to the concept of yoga. So this one of the 10 concepts which has been broken down from yoga by Patanjali, we're now giving so much onus to it and so much time to it and really knowing ourselves in relation to it, that as a consequence, we are actually moving towards knowing our relationship to yoga further. And so that is through that process, we are seeing our resistances. So, you know, whether it's my book or someone else's book, or maybe you've got your own system for reflecting on the yamas and niyamas, but you'll, if you take one and you really just chew over it, it's going to demand that you look at your life, and it's going to demand that you look at how you're engaging in life. And through that looking at how you engage in your life through your behaviors, you'll start to get a sense of how you see yourself being a little bit different to how you actually are. You'll start to see how your perception of what, in this case, non-attachment means shifts and turns and grows and gets deeper, becomes confusing, starts to become shaken up. And the whole concept of non-attachment, or whatever the concept might be, starts to kind of give way to this other knowing. And that other knowing is essentially what yoga is going to be. It's that other knowing is going to be the knowing of something which is unknowable. It's going to be the knowing of something which can't be put into words. So your experience will become very much non-definable, and something you can't put a commentary on, that you'll just become, I suppose, gobsmacked by your own relationship to non-attachment itself. And at that point, the ego doesn't have a lot to say about it, because at that point, it's not about the ego. It's about you having seen the ego and how it was doing things. And like you said, you're stepped back from it. You're not there as the ahamkara. You're there as more as the buddhi, and moving towards the experience of transcending the buddhi.
Right. There's some separation or distance between the observer and the participant. And you're sort of able to observe this ego that is participating in all of these things, but not get as involved as you once did.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the all the terms, like we talked about the concepts, the five yamas and niyamas being offered to us by Sage Patanjali as a way to kind of move towards yoga, which is a concept which is just beyond our capacity to conceptualize. But the framework that we have of the ego, and then the ahamkara, the ego, the buddhi, the intelligence, and just all these frameworks in themselves become seen, you know. So it's not just that our seeing ourselves as the ego and how the ego is working. It's like everything, the whole structure of it becomes maya, is seen through. So it's kind of the whole system of deluded perception which we have bought into starts to become revealed to us, but not in a way where we can't relate to it. We can still relate to it, because we still have the mechanism of mind working in its sound, reliable way. But it's just that the mind itself is seen as the apparatus which is responsible for our having bought into everything. And when I say bought into everything, even language, like where the words we're speaking, everything, the whole thing is, you know, it's very Matrix-like. but it's very easy to talk about it. And, you know, even in the Matrix, when you're imagining all those green numbers floating on the black screen, it's, you know, we can, all of that, even our imaginings are part of this. So there's nothing intrinsically reliable on anything that we're producing with the mind. There's nothing really that is going to facilitate our saying that we know, because we can't actually know.
That's the whole thing, right? There really is no good or bad or right or wrong. Yeah. Ultimately, sure you've experienced that. And so, and then, but people, you know, when they talk about the yamas and niyamas, of course, they think in terms of these mental filters and labels of, you know, right and wrong, black and white, good and bad. And all these things. But of course, in ultimate reality, we're already completely pure. And when we begin to see things objectively, and these states of oneness consciousness, we realize, oh, okay, well, this entire framework I had before of right and wrong, good and bad, doesn't even exist. You know, but the problem is that we have to go back out into the world, don't we? And we have to interact with others, and we have to have jobs and relationships and all these things, which require some type of structure, which require of us some type of analysis of what is right and what is wrong, what is ethical, what is unethical, what is moral, what is immoral. Otherwise, we can't have a functioning society, you know.
True. I think what you're saying is very true. And, you know, especially as practitioners, we're very much wanting to be responsible in how we engage in society, and that the structures of society are part and parcel of what it means to express within this world, because it's what favors the expression of life itself. You know, we've come up with mechanisms to facilitate life, to, and some of them can be questionable or not questionable, but it's something which is unfolding. I think the challenge is that when we talk about structure or constructs, we can sometimes see it in a negative way, as in, you know, it's all just a construct. You know, when we talk about, oh, don't believe that, that's just a construct, or they're just playing games. But it's not in that way. I see it more as, you know, an actor getting on stage and gets involved in the production of the play. He's not like, I'm not doing this, or she or he is not like saying to themselves, I'm not getting involved. This is a farce. This is just a construct. It's not even a real thing. When they're actually allowing themselves to buy into it, because that's where the enjoyment is. That's where the expression of life is, in
drama,
that context.
Yeah.
Drama. And so Maya, you know, we can talk about it because it's also referred to as Leela, the play.
Leela, the divine play, God's beautiful movie. Yeah.
That's
a sort of a nicer, rosier connotation, isn't it? Rather than Maya, the great illusion, you know.
But I think it's important to have both concepts. So we're moving away from, first of all, just to say, we're moving away from looking at constructs as being something which is negative, or something which, oh yeah, I need to break away and there's something better that I'm going to experience, and, you know, nirvana, or, you know, whatever term you might want to use, heaven, or the utopia, or the great place that I'm going to, you know, even to say self-realization or liberation of consciousness, I'm going to have it all figured out then. There is no I in that context. So there's no point in saying I'm going to have it all figured out and I'm going to have a great experience, because there is no I in that context. The I has, you've literally undone it to get to that. But while you're still in a manifested expression, while you're still expressing through whatever degree of manifested reality, mental, emotional, and physical, you do have the opportunity, if and while you're involved in the practice, to cultivate your capacity to see that if things are seen as constructs, not because they're good or bad, but that they're constructs, then you can play in it in a way which is going to be supportive of the play itself, and which is going to allow the play to run in a way which is supportive of everybody else who's playing in it. And the whole play is seen as something, as a unified expression, as one thing, which is nobody, you're trying to do your best to play your role while also encouraging everybody else to play the role and participate in it and have joy in it and experience the joy of it. So the Leela then, I think it's useful to have Maya and Leela, just because Maya kind of shoves us to say, well, actually, the reality you see is a drama, insofar as everything that you think you are has been limited down and condensed into an ego perspective. There's so much more. And so Leela, but then when you break that open, then Leela is when you're able to be on engaging in everything that's going on and say, yeah, I've got this role, I've got this perspective, I'm using the ego to kind of help me to do that. But that ego is just a tool I pick up and put down. Like there's no sense of being, oh yeah. And then in that way, then it's the play that God enjoys, and God being that part of us which is without I.
Yeah, that's nice. A tool that we pick up and put down.
Yeah.
That kind of sums it all up. That's really nice. What do you say to folks who are coming to yoga, you know, for the first time, and they might see the yamas and the niyamas, and it might sort of dissuade them or demotivate them in a certain sense because they have a certain lifestyle that they enjoy, and they see yoga as being sort of puritanical. In other words, one of the most common questions I get from folks that are just starting on the path is, can I still drink and, you know, smoke pot and eat mushrooms and have sex and all these things and practice yoga, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And so they see the yamas and niyamas, and they think, and then they look at people like Yogananda and these saintly figures, and they think, oh gosh, well, if I'm going to practice yoga and meditation or start along this path, I'm going to have to quit all of these things that, you know, yogis consider to be bad or what have you. And personally, I'm not a puritanical seeker. I make no secret of that. And it just doesn't work for me. I've tried it, you know, and, but I've come to have a good relationship with all of these sort of sense pleasures and all of that. And they're no longer addictive or compulsive. So what do you say to folks that think they have to completely change their lifestyle? They have to leave behind all of these sense pleasures, in order to start off on this yoga path?
What do I say to people? I don't think I've been confronted with that question as much as maybe you have, but what comes to my mind straight away when you're talking about it is, when we were talking about earlier, that we already have our kind of usual way of dealing with things built into us before we even get to yoga. So when somebody arrives to yoga and they see these things, it's almost like they might say, yes, I've got something which is going to make me perfect. I'm going to follow it. I'm going to do it to the rule. And then, you know, and they can really buy into it and lap it up. And then you have other people who might be more, you know, just shake it off as being, I prefer to just do the meditation stuff. I'm not really into these rules and stuff like that. And so I think that's just dependent on the psyche of the individual themselves. And between those two that I've just pointed out, there's a whole spectrum of people, you know, that can be a kind of a complex mix of both of those and other things. So in terms of what can be said, I think that there's no real, no real use in over encouraging or over demanding or persuading people to do things, full stop. And in ancient cultures, or maybe not even in so ancient cultures, but in older times, and specifically to where we've read the stories coming from India, a master would be reluctant to share anything until the person actually started to see that there was value in it. The master would be reluctant to even get into sharing any formal meditation practices or formal practices of any kind until the person showed or demonstrated some kind of respect for what the tradition or what the teaching was about. I think maybe in the West, we can be very open, and not that it's a bad thing, but that we can be open to sharing the teachings. And maybe we're, as a result, confronted with this kind of, yeah, fine, I'll just pick and choose what I want. You know, I was in this other tradition and they taught this, and now your tradition is teaching this. And, you know, there's all this kind of questions. And it's just the lay of the land at the moment. It's just because we're in a time when there's a lot of easily accessible teachings. And some of the teachings are coming from very intense spiritual traditions. So you get this kind of like nonchalant kind of attitude to teachings, which in their day were considered gold, you know. And as teachers, we have maybe a stance or a position where we want to respect the teaching in that way, but at the same time we find ourselves wanting to help the individual. And so how do we navigate that? What do we say to them? I as I said, I haven't really come across or been asked that question, but I think, well, maybe in some ways, in simple ways, maybe even around dinner tables and
You're
stuff.
You're freaking Irish, man. Are you kidding me? No one's ever well, said, can I keep going to the pub and, you know.
Not in a formal setting, but in maybe around the dinner table and more conversational, people might have brought up the question in their own way. And I don't have an answer that is absolute. Like, it's not like, no, you can't do that. I think essentially it comes back to the whole thing of we're trying to purify our conscious awareness. So if you have a glass of wine, you get that warm, fuzzy feeling in your head, but you're still got a degree of clarity, depending on who you are and how much you've drank and all that other stuff. But if you go on to five glasses of wine, there's an effect there that's taking place that is hindering your capacity to have clarity, clarified conscious awareness. So straight away, you know yourself, because of your adherence to the practice, there's an intuitive kind of sense of, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to do that kind of thing. For an individual who's getting involved in the practices and still has tendencies to, let's say, clutter their conscious awareness through their different behaviors and activities, I think the teaching will have to be, or probably organically, will be shared in relation to where they are in terms of their life situation. So somebody who goes out and has pints at the weekend, or somebody who smokes a joint or two, and these different things, they can't be told that it's right or wrong. But when they're given the teachings should be only in so far, or would best serve them, that they don't get teachings which require a greater amount of self-application and self-discipline, that the teachings are more related to what they're willing to give themselves. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, and also, I guess, now in your book, do you differentiate at all between, you know, how a renunciate might approach the yamas and niyamas versus a householder? Because of course, we've kind of been discussing, I think, you know, what might be appropriate for a householder like us, you know, who's living in the world, has a job, has, you know, family, responsibilities, duties, and things like that, versus maybe this looks a little different for someone who, you know, lives in an ashram or monastery or something like that.
Well, I think that gets back to the fundamental idea that we were talking at the very beginning, that communities, if it's an ashram or a monastery, there's a community there which is going to help to provide a support in a way where the average person doesn't have. So I think the book that I've written and has laid out would serve anybody in that community in a similar way as it would serve somebody from a householder's point of view. But what you're saying about our conversation so far being more kind of around the householder, I personally feel that it's the age of the householder in lots of ways. I've never really said that before. These are new words coming out of my mouth in this context. But
what do you mean by the householder?
It's about the idea that, you know, we talk about the yugas and we talk about the teaching. And there's a part of me which imagines as well. And I imagine the idea that the teaching, when we were in the previous gold age, and when people were more skilled at living intuitively, let's say, that there was no need for monasteries, and there was no need for it, because the community was all living a shared experience to whatever degree. This is, again, as I say, I'm just imagining. I don't have any memories from this or anything. This is just concepts in my mind.
You're more than welcome to speculate. I talk a lot about the yugas and on this podcast, and I often refer to the fact that we're sort of on the cusp, you know, between Kali and Dwapara, just coming out of Kali Yuga, this dark age, entering into this energy age, and how that affects how we approach our spirituality and all of that. So please, feel free to just flow. It's all good.
So, based on that, then, the Kali Yuga was a point when everything was more dark, more ignorant. And we talk of through the yugas, the process of moving away from the golden age down through the yugas, down to the Kali Yuga. So I'm imagining, speculating, as you said, that efforts were made to keep a teaching alive, which was going to help people as best it could. An attempt to provide a means or a teaching or stories, you know, the Mahabharata, the different texts, to provide some means for people to, even though they're in darkness, have something there that would guide them and support them to whatever degree. And I imagine as a consequence of that, that there was individuals who said, we're going to set up these areas which are specifically designed for people to be the beehive, as Sri Yukteswar uses, to offer a kind of sacred zone for this teaching, a sacred zone for that to be. Now, I don't think we're in a you know, as you said, we're just moving into away from the Kali Yuga, moving into Svastvara Yuga, and it's just we're moving into it. But I think all the same that the idea of moving or living in a monastery is something which is something which I see less likely for people, and it's also something which has been attacked many ways because of unfortunate and in often cases disgraceful behaviors which happen in certain monasteries here in the West, well, in Ireland specifically, within different institutional organizations. There can be stories that go with it which has kind of caused its collapse. And now I'm not talking about just yoga, I'm talking about spiritual traditions.
Certainly.
But it's so the idea that we need to kind of go off and live in seclusion, I think that in itself is something which we can kind of analyze through the yamas and niyamas. You know, what, you know, when we're looking at, we're trying to figure out our relationship to ourselves through the principles of the yamas and niyamas so that we can go on and experience the concept or the experience of yoga. We're looking through the yamas and niyamas and we ask ourselves, well, how do I relate to each of those? I think if we rigorously perform this act and we're the kind of person who's inclined to live in a forest, there is, it's going to be easier to tell the truth when you don't really have to talk very much to people. When it's going to be easier to be nonviolent when the whole system's set up for you. So everything, there's a different experience for somebody in a monastery or in an ashram. And then when you talk about a recluse, somebody living totally off on their own in the woods, that's a whole other experience. But like we talked about earlier in the podcast, that almost is reframing our informal living. You know, I talk about formal spiritual practices and informal practices, and the informal, like the formal practices, are they're similar in nature to for everybody, regardless of where they are, because you're trying to internalize your attention and experience your inner world. But the informal ones, where you're engaging in life, for somebody living as a recluse, they're reframing all of that that experience. And in some ways, they're trying to replicate what's been going on in their meditation practice. But for the average householder, we're not trying to replicate it. We're deep in the reality of society. We're deep in what's going on, and so it's a harder practice. But it's depending on who you are and what your disposition is, and your duty or your dharma or your truth. You might need to be in the middle of a capital city and perform your duty. And so the idea of, like you said, the book or our conversation so far kind of pertain more to householders. It's just because I feel that it's the harder situation. It's a situation which is going to be more challenging in terms of we have constant feedback to us. For individuals who are living as recluses or living in a society which is small and where there's a lot of space for them and different things, they may have challenges because they do get direct feedback from their relationships with their fellow monks or fellow disciples or whatever it might be. And there might be internal politics that they have to navigate, but they're likely to have maybe a leader or somebody who's going to guide them or some sense of structure which is going to facilitate their being able to navigate that in some way or another. Whereas for the average person, while they might have a yoga teacher and they may have classes that they can attend and different things, there's a lot of variables which is feeding back to them all the time. So I don't think any experience, human experience, I don't think it can be qualified as easier or more difficult. Absolutely. Obviously, we can measure things in terms of crises and childhood experiences and all these different things which we can weigh up and we can look at as being traumatic and challenging and all these different things. But ultimately, for us, we see the world from what we know of the world. And so whether it's somebody living in a forest on their own, where we might look at it and say, that's very easy, or we might say, that's really hard, they're on their own the whole time. And then we compare it to somebody who might be a mother or a father of three or four children who's living in a small house and trying to make enough money to pay their rent. And you're looking at the two situations. It's always going to be a perspective on somebody else's situation. And what really matters to us is our perspective on our own situation. And our own situation is we're the best person to really know that. It's the challenge is putting ourselves in a position where we can reflect on it and do it honestly, because we're very good at reflecting. I know for me with the yamas and niyamas, I reflected quite rigorously on the yamas and niyamas throughout my time since I began with yoga. I feel, or as far as I can remember, I definitely have notebooks where I went through the yamas and niyamas and reflected and had nighttime questions and all this kind of stuff. But there's a capacity within us to really fool ourselves. And that's why with the book, I feel it kind of does, it takes an approach which helps to angle our relationship to the yamas and niyamas in different ways, so that we're not always just seeing it from one perspective, you know, so the algorithm shifts so that how we relate to one of the yamas or one of the niyamas, if we go with the example of non-attachment, we're starting to shift our perspective on it. We're moving around it. We're dancing with it. We're playing with it. We're toying with it. As opposed to when we're on our own and we just look at the yamas and niyamas and we pick out non-attachment and we say, okay, I'll reflect on that. But we're very good at fooling ourselves and repeating things. And maybe we recognize something, but we don't really pay enough attention to it. Or we kind of put an excuse in there, or we toy with it in a way where we don't really have to do anything, or we don't really make any really shift in terms of our relationship to it. So my hope is that the book, in the way it's been laid out, if it's adhered to in that way, will really help the person to kind of analyze their sense of self in terms of these principles. And then not because the principles in themselves are what's important, but because how they know themselves in relation to life is what's important. And the principles are a means to doing that.
Perhaps what you're describing is svadhyaya, this idea of self-knowledge, analyzing the self, working with, you know, getting to know our tendencies, getting to know our patterns, getting to know our sort of default reactions and impulses and all of these things. Not because we're going to rid ourselves completely of them, but because a greater awareness of how this is all working can lead us to more peace, more tranquility, more happiness, and more spiritual evolution.
Yeah, just on that note, I'm very careful with the words peace and happiness and things like this, because you know the expression, you probably heard it when you were in CSA, from Ron Linden, used to say it quite a lot. Before enlightenment, chopping or carrying water, right, chopping wood. After enlightenment, and just the idea of peace and happiness. I know that, again, they're words, and so, you know, the way you're speaking them might be different to the way I hear them, and I accept that. But I think I'm always a little bit careful, just because the world, life is just life, and so the challenge is always going to be there, and the ups and downs are always going to be there. And I suppose when you talk about awareness, that's the key thing. That the awareness isn't being caught, the conscious awareness, which is being, its attention is being called upon by the experience, but it's not being distorted by that layer which is in between, which is all the blueprint of all the different impressions and all the different shit that has been splurted across our psyche. So, you know, it's now that there's nothing distorting what's being experienced. So the conscious awareness is still being directed to the problem. It's still there. There may even be an emotional response within the body. That's still there because it's a bioorganic mechanism and it just does what it does. And so we have it. But the conscious awareness observes all of these experiences, but isn't being dictated by them in a way where it's all about the ego. You know, it's more, nothing is going to change radically in terms of the world, there'll still be problems and challenges, and we'll still have people talking bad about us, and we'll still have this going on and that going on. And so the idea of peace and happiness, I think, can sometimes elude, a bit like perfection, it can kind of point in the direction of that everything's going to be a roller coaster ride. You know, everything's just going to be great crack and there's going to be no problems, when in fact there can be loads of problems. It's just your relationship to it is very much one where if you do feel the anger in you, or if there is a biochemical response in relation or in relation to something that you've just experienced, it's something which you know to be occurring as an aspect of manifested creation, as opposed to that part of you which is observing manifested creation, the seer. Yeah.
Nice. Well said. Yeah. Well, cool. Thank you so much for doing this.
And it's been a pleasure.
You want to share any final words with the listeners about your book, or how to find the book, or how to learn more about you and your offerings?
Well, me and my offerings, my name is David McGrath, and I have a website, which is davidmcgrath.ie. And so a lot of what I do is there. And then in regards to the book, which was, I think it was launched last October. It was in the works for a little time before that, a good bit of time before that. But it's available on Amazon. Now, Amazon's an interesting beast because different countries have different rules and it has availability of the book depending on the country. Yeah. But it should be available on Amazon. And if you're in the United States, Amazon.com. And I think it sells on in the United States for $15 or $16. And the book itself, you know, I've laid it out to be a tool which can be used for a period of just under 3 years.
Which, oh, wow. Gosh.
Some people say is a bit ambitious. Or, you know, the different people have had their own comments on this, which is fair. But like we understand of everybody and of life itself, if you pick up the book and you buy the book, you'll do what you want with the book. And I have no say in that. I've laid it out as a kind of a 3-year plan just because it's a support that we don't also often have in our lives. And we talked about that as being something which is missing for people, something which is going to help them to work through their psychological resistances to the practice itself in all its different guises. So the book is made up of sequences, 16 sequences. And then in each sequence contains each of the yamas and niyamas. So one sequence is made up of 10 weeks. And each week is dedicated to one of the yamas and niyamas. At the start of the book, the whole book includes a little short text, which can be read and reread over and over. But it also includes writing exercises, and then just some reflective exercises, and just ways to kind of pull apart your relationship to the principle of the yama or niyama. And then after sequence 6, moving into sequence 7, there's specific practices which can be applied for as you engage in life through your day-to-day living, and then you can reflect on in the evening when you come back home. So 16 sequences and 10 weeks in each sequence, and because of this, as you can imagine, it takes up a period of time. With the book, there are supplementary activities. There's a QR code at the back of the book, which can be scanned, and they're related to some of the activities within the book. They're guided reflections for, again, nurturing and developing our relationship to the yama and niyama. And then there's guided meditations as well, just to try and see past them and experience more of our own self, the seer, in relation to everything. Nice. So that's it.
Cool. Very cool. Well, I'll definitely recommend it to my students, the ones that understand English.
Very good. Yeah, I've no Spanish translation yet, but you know, never say never, but it won't be soon.
Yeah, it's an awful lot of work, as I've learned, translating books into Spanish. It's pretty time consuming. But if you have someone else do it for you, then it's not time consuming at all. so maybe that's a possibility for you.
Well, I'll keep you
pay
updated.
Somebody else to do it. Well,
Chris,
cool.
I've enjoyed this a lot. Right here now in Ireland, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I have an appointment coming up. I'm imagining you're going to edit this from maybe the podcast. You don't have to say this, but we can do our goodbyes if you like.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. It's been an enjoyable and meaningful conversation, I think.
Absolutely.
Very good. Very good.
Okay, let's...